I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, we pay tribute to the recently passed sci-fi, fantasy, and speculative fiction author, Harlan Ellison. Although Ellison passed away in his Los Angeles home on June 28th, 2018, at the age of 84, it is unlikely that his legacy will soon be forgotten. Notorious for being one of the most cantankerous personalities in science fiction and fantasy, and for hating being called a science fiction and fantasy author, Ellison was a prolific short story writer, whose books included Dreams with Sharp Teeth, Deathbird Stories, Pain God, and many others. He also helped write for a number of TV shows, including The Outer Limits and the 1980s Twilight Zone revival. And perhaps most famously, he wrote what many consider to be the best episode of the original Gene Roddenberry run of Star Trek, entitled The City on the Edge of Forever. In this episode, you'll hear three different writers who have all been in some way touched by Ellison's work, or inspired by it. First up, Cultured Vultures' Ben Arzadi. And then, author Joshua Ellis. And finally, Zero Books' C. Derek Varn. Without further ado, let's kick off the Parallax Views Harlan Ellison tribute with a conversation featuring Cultured Vultures' Ben Arzadi. Welcome to Parallax Views, Ben Arzadi.
Thank you for having me back on.
So I wanted to have you on. This is the second time I'm having you on for a tribute show. The first one was with Adam Parfrey, for Adam Parfrey, I should say. This one is for the recently passed away Harlan Ellison, the great sci-fi author, although I know he'd hate being called a sci-fi author. He thought of himself more as like a Kafka author. How did you become familiar with Harlan Ellison and his writing?
I actually first read Ellison back when I was in either middle school or early high school. I was a big Stephen King fan at the time, and I read Dan's Macabre. And in that, he recommended Strange Wine, which my library had. And I read it, and it really stuck with me, especially like the first story, Croatoan. That one still sticks with me. That story, it's about a guy who's a sort of like a sort of a cad. He convinces his girlfriend to commit a self-induced abortion and throw it into the sewer, but she even convinces him to go down into the sewer to get it. And when he's down there, he discovers a civilization of living fetuses and crocodiles, and he becomes a father figure to them, which is, it's a very odd, very almost kind of gross story, but it doesn't feel gross. It's a kind of story that you in the hands of another author would just feel like a gross out story, but with Hotline Ellison's, it felt like a very touching story about learning responsibility, essentially. And from then on, I read the books of his I remember reading are Alone Against Tomorrow, The Essential Ellison, and I've also read a bunch of his essays that I could find. I've watched his entire Watching series. It's all very fascinating stuff. And I've also played the computer game of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
I was going to mention that. The video game is actually really great. And I remember in interviews, he said he wanted to make the game so that you couldn't win. And I guess the studio behind that game was like, we can't do that, Harlan.
Yeah, I could kind of see him wanting to make it so that, like, no matter what you do, you end up with the ending. I could still see it, like, being made similarly where you end up as the blob creature at the end but still have, like, a semi-good ending where you manage to save the humans on the moon.
Yeah, for my listeners that don't know, how would you give a brief rundown of not just the game, but also the short story it's based on? I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. That's one of his best.
If I had to describe the story, it's like a angry nightmare. It's like an angry nightmare is how I describe the story's mood. The plot is that it's a post-apocalyptic story where a supercomputer that gains sentience destroyed all living creatures on the Earth, except for five survivors who he uses his powers to keep alive and torture. The spoiler for the short story is that one of the survivors manages to figure out a way to kill the other survivors and put them out of their misery. But before he can kill himself, the allied supercomputer, the angry computer, it turns him into a blob-like creature that can barely see, that can barely hear, that perceives time in an extremely slow manner and is constantly suffering. And of course, that's where the title comes from, that I have no mouth and I must scream because of the agony he's in.
Right, right. It's a really great story, and the video game itself is actually really great because it's like it's almost like a game of ethics. Like, you have to make ethical decisions throughout the whole game, and you get a different ending based on whether you make those ethical choices or not. Like, there's one character who has to go back in time to, like, Nazi Germany because he was one of the scientists or whatever, and you have to, like, make different choices to get a different ending.
Right. That was the character of Nimdok, who, like, a spoiler for the game, is while he's exploring Auschwitz, he discovers that he himself was Jewish and gave up his own Jewish parents to the Nazis. And we also find that some of his research was an early predecessor to the technology that would later create Allied Master Computer.
Yeah, it's really a story in a video game that's sort of like it's straight out of Elon Musk's greatest nightmares.
Yeah, it feels very very ahead of its time with the fact.
Like, what's that thing called? It's like an internet meme now. Roko's Basilisk. Like, that's basically what it is. The AI in the game.
Yeah, I remember you talked about that when you spoke with the author of Near Reaction, A Basilisk. But yeah, that's basically what it is. It's like the fears of like what AI becoming self-aware would be like was a theme that's been explored in science fiction for a while. And with that, it almost comes up with the idea of that being self-aware is such a fucking nightmare that that an all-powerful AI would use it to just lash out in the worst way possible.
It's almost like The AI in that story is sort of like what I imagine an AI version of like Thomas Ligotti would be like if Thomas Ligotti were an evil supercomputer.
Yeah, and in the computer game itself, the Allied Master Computer is actually voiced by Harlan Ellison himself, and he actually does a really great job.
Yeah, it's a really great game. I really recommend it. I'm glad you brought it up. And Ellison's voiceovers for it are really great. You know, I think he sort of relates to the supercomputer in some ways.
Yeah, that's the thing with his writings. His writing is very I would almost call it like expressionist. It's very angry at times. I recently read one article about him that said that his stories were almost more like tantrums than anything else, which they meant as more of a compliment because to describe like the anger that could come out of them at times.
Well, I was gonna say I've seen obituaries that sort of like point out that he was cantankerous, or some people have called him an asshole. But I don't know. The thing about Harlan Ellison for me, I always thought there was like an extremely strong moral and ethical core to what he was trying to get across in his writing.
Right, and I tend to think that's where his cantankerousness came from. He had this sort of sense that we could be better than we are, and he felt the need to lash out at those who refused to be.
Yeah, he was not a nihilist. You know, he was angry because he thought we could do better.
Yeah, and to compare it to, like, another author like Thomas Ligotti, who, you know, is, in fact, does not believe we can do better and believes that, you know, we need to drive ourselves extinct. I can't imagine him lashing out like that. He seems like in a social setting he would be very, very quiet and straightforward.
I mean, I have my own thoughts on Ligotti, because Ligotti, it does seem like he's still like a utilitarian, so he wants things to be as painless as possible for everyone around until we go extinct or whatever. But that's a whole nother discussion.
Yeah.
With Harlan Ellison, there's another really good story. I don't know if you've seen the Twilight Zone adaptation of it. Have you ever heard of Shatter Day?
I haven't seen that episode yet. I did read the story at one point, but it's been so long I can't remember much about that one.
Okay, I'm going to recommend that to listeners because it's from the Twilight Zone revival in the 80s, and it also is one of the first starring roles of Bruce Willis. And it's sort of this Jungian plot, so Jordan Peterson fans will like it, where it's like there's two... Bruce Willis's character is like a complete asshole, and then he has like a doppelganger, and the doppelganger is like a good version of him. And eventually the doppelganger wins out and sort of takes over his life, and the bad version of Bruce Willis like fades out into oblivion. Typical of Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, definitely sounds like something he would write. Yeah, because I know that he wrote several original Outer Limits episodes. Well, not several, a few Outer Limits episodes. And I'll admit that I had a bit of an aversion to the Twilight 80s revival because I love the 50s Rod Stewart version so much, but yeah.
Rod Serling.
Rod Serling. The words are hard. I've heard enough good things about like Harlan Ellison's episode that I do really need to get around to watching them.
What Outer Limits episodes have you seen out of curiosity that he did?
There was that one, I think it's called Soldier, which is, I believe that's the one that was accused of being the one that the Terminator ripped off and that Harlan Ellison won a lawsuit against James Cameron for. The other one, I cannot remember. I'm pretty sure I saw it at one point.
Demon with a Glass Hand.
Oh, yeah, that one. I don't remember anything about that one, unfortunately. I saw that one.
Is the Soldier one good? I need to watch Soldier.
Yeah, I remember it being pretty good. It's been a long time since I've watched them, so.
That's fair. I'm just trying to throw some of the TV work he did out there. I know he was very cantankerous with with people in the film world. I don't know if you read about that in his essays at all.
Yeah, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was iRobot that he was writing. He ended up getting kicked off of that because he got so pissed off at one of the executives and basically told them to go fuck off, and he got fired.
There's a legend that he worked for Disney for one day, if you know about that.
Yeah, I don't know if it is just a rumor or not, but the thing is, like, he was hired to write for Disney, and I actually recall the thing he wrote about it where he says, "I have no idea why they hired me. I'm the guy with a hook for a hand." And he, at lunch or something like that, he was talking with his new colleagues that they should do like a Disney porn film, just sort of joking with them. But one of the executives overheard him and fired him for that.
So that gives a nice insight into who Harlan Ellison was. A great joker.
Yeah.
But are there any other stories that you're a fan of that you would recommend to fans? I have one of his books around here. I'm forgetting which one. I think it may have been titled I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream and Other Stories. So...
Yeah, one of my favorite pieces of ephemera, I never bothered to look up where it came from, but it's when he talks to Robin Williams about how he knew L. Ron Hubbard, and apparently he was, like, present at the conversation where L. Ron Hubbard talked about wanting to start a religion in order to make money, and about taking various ideas from different things, like... Reich's Oregon machine and things like that. I definitely recommend people look that up. You can find that pretty easily on YouTube. You just type in Harlan Ellison, L. Ron Hubbard.
And for listeners that may not know, what was the TV series watching? People can find a lot of videos on YouTube, but what was that?
It was a back in the day when the Sci-Fi Channel was still Sci-Fi Channel and wasn't SIFI. It had a show called Sci-Fi Buzz, which was like a commentary on the sci-fi world in general. And Harlan Ellison had a section on there called Watching, where he would talk about the world of science fiction and things like that. He would sometimes give recommendations of books to people. He had one segment where he read from the book Mind Fields. One of the more interesting ones was where he was his talk about women in science fiction, where he talked about how he was very much on board with the idea of bringing more women into science fiction, but noted that the science fiction that was coming out being written by women wasn't any more innovative or interesting than what the men were doing, and he did like place just as much. Blame on the publishers as he did the writers themselves. He was very irritated by the idea that that pulpy stories about furry creatures would sell well, while stories that were cerebral and interesting did not sell that well back in the day.
He would also, on Watching, he would get very, very angry about publishers and be like, "You should pay your writers, damn it!"
Yeah, yeah. I was going through it again recently, and there was one where he talked about how he was very irritated with the restrictions that the Science Fiction Writers of America would put on the Lifetime Achievement Award, because he believed that there were too many authors who are close to dying who deserve to get it that weren't going to get it in their lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, he was a very outspoken, he was a real defender of the people in a lot of ways. He's kind of like almost a left populist in some ways, not just with publishing, but you know, like what you said about women in sci-fi. Like, I've heard accusations that Harlan was sexist, but I never got that impression necessarily. I think he was misanthropic, but I think he was really for like civil rights and, you know, supportive of women writing and all that kind of stuff.
Right, because he actually like marched in the civil rights movement, so you know, he was very much on board with all of that.
See, I didn't know that he marched. Like, was he marching with like MLK and people like that? Or...
I don't know if it was directly with MLK. I just know like during the marches, he actually did go down south and participate in at least one of them.
See, that's really cool. That's sort of what I've always gotten out of Harlan Ellison. He was like the guy that would rage against the injustice of things.
Right. Exactly. And it's. I recall one of his essays being about in the. I believe they call them the Tombs of New York City while he was doing research for his novel about juvenile delinquency in New York City. And it was sort of his indictment of the prison system.
Yeah, almost like a who is the author that wrote Oil and the Jungle? Sinclair Lewis?
No. He that was the one who wrote It Can't Happen Here. It's Sinclair something. I can't remember his first name.
Upton Sinclair.
Upton Sinclair, yeah.
But yeah, that novel sounds like something Upton Sinclair would have done, you know? Like Harlan writing about juvenile delinquency.
Yeah, that's one of the things, like earlier you said he didn't like being called a science fiction writer. But when you like go through his stories, Well, science fiction was, like, what he was primarily in, like, the novels he's written. Like, his only, like, full-length novel is called Spider Kiss, and it's a realistic novel about a rock star. And one of his early, it's technically a novella, but it was published by itself. It is called Web of the City, which was about juvenile delinquency. And one story of his that really sticks with me is called, let me just look this up so I get it right. It's called, it sounds funny now, but it's called The Return of Miss Anklestrap Wedgie, which is a reference to a shoe, but that's not what wedgie means to most people now. But it was a really affecting and really powerful story about a sort of a washed up Hollywood actress. And I definitely think that's a story that sticks out from him and has no fantastic elements in it.
Yeah, he's like I said at the beginning, he always would say that he was more in the tradition of like a cerebral author like Edgar Allan Poe, who I guess he did horror, but a lot of what Poe was dealing with was sort of psychological issues within literature. And then also Kafka. He was big on like comparing himself to Kafka.
Yeah, so he was very passionate about science fiction, but he didn't want to be boxed in.
Well, he's very different from, like, a lot of what you get in sci-fi. He's certainly not, like, you know, a Vox Day-type guy who just, like, wants to write about, like, you know, his right-wing politics through sci-fi. Or, like, some Conan the Barbarian-type shit. Or, like he wouldn't write something like the Gore novels that John Norman did, you know?
No, I can't picture him writing something like that. He definitely did do political stories, but... even his political stories were very were very dark and very odd at times. Like his one
they're a bit more subtle. They're a bit more subtle than the kind of authors that I was naming.
For the most part, there were a couple stories where he was a little ham-fisted. Like that, I recall reading one short story which was about a skinhead who turned out to be Jewish, which was like a very obvious kind of story. And there was another like anti-war story that was, of course, very obvious with its methods. It was one of his earlier stories. Which was about a soldier from the future who comes back in time and very graphically describes like the new weapons that were being developed, and it sort of pushes people to move away from war. But I think this was written before, before knowledge about the nuclear bomb was like well known. So it was the nuclear bomb happened and war still happens. So
it's almost reminiscent of like Kurt Vonnegut with the Barnhouse effect story. You know, they're sort of similar in that way.
Kind of, yeah. But like I said, those were very like early stories of him. So I don't really blame them for being that ham-fisted.
So do you have any other favorite stories before we start rapping?
One of the favorites of his, I cannot remember the title of it, but it's a story about a method actor who, like, almost literally becomes the characters he plays. Like, in one story, he plays a homeless man, and so what he does is he goes into, like, a thrift shop, buys some ratty clothes, leaves his own clothes there, and goes and lives out on the streets until the play starts. And at one point, the actor plays a murderer and ends up murdering someone in real life. So he's put in an asylum. And as as he's in there and with nothing to do, with no character to try to get into, he starts regressing back through all the characters he previously played. And the ending is a bit surreal and hard to describe, but it's basically about the doctors, like, figuring out that he's gone back to the first role he's ever played and waiting for him to regress back into his real self. I cannot remember the name of that story, but it always stuck with me.
Yeah, there's like a huge psychological and even at times an almost Freudian like element to a lot of Ellison's work. Like I said, Shatterday makes like pretty specific references to like Jung and the shadow. So there's always been that element to Ellison's writing too.
Yeah, definitely. This is one of the reasons that he's stuck with me and why I think he was one of the best short story writers of the 20th century, and he'll very much be missed.
Well, I think that's a great way to close. But first, I want to ask you, what do you think Harlan Ellison's legacy is going to be? Do you think I don't think he'll be soon forgotten, or at least I hope not.
No, I don't think he's going to be forgotten anytime soon. I think he is still going to be remembered as a great short story writer to people who read science fiction and even readers in general. And even then, I think he'll still be remembered for his work on Star Trek, on Babylon 5, and so forth.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that he worked on Star Trek and Babylon 5. People forget a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, that's actually when he did die, most of the headlines I saw around were things like that he was a Star Trek, but he's a writer on Star Trek, and that a lot of people believe that he wrote like the best Star Trek episode, City on the Edge of Forever.
Well, I wanna thank you again for coming on to pay tribute to Harlan Ellison, and Harlan's like a legend to me. I mean, he took on James Cameron, he beat James Cameron in court, and then he just wrote all these great stories. So here's to Harlan Ellison, right?
Right. Here's to Harlan Ellison, one of the greats.
Nimdok! How are things in the pastry corps, Nimdok? Tell me again how you saw the smoke from the furnaces and you thought they might be roasting chickens. Or don't you want to talk about all that? About your pal, the good Dr. Mengele. For everyone else, it must be hell. But it must be heaven for you, eh, my good friend? We're so much alike. We enjoy the same pleasures, mein good brother.
And that was a clip from the video game version of Ellison's I Have No Mouth, and I Must Scream, featuring the Allied Master Computer, AM or AM, as voiced by Harlan Ellison himself, verbally tormenting the Nazi collaborator Nimdok, whom Ben mentioned in the conversation. Next up, a conversation with author Joshua Ellis, whose new book, Everyone I Know is Brokenhearted, Collected Essays and Writing, 1998 to 2008, comes highly recommended by Parallax Views. In this conversation, we delve into the ways in which Ellison influenced Ellis, and much more. And now, here's Joshua Ellis for his take on the life and legacy of Harlan Ellison. Welcome to the Parallax Views podcast, Joshua Ellis.
Hi, how's it going?
So I wanted to have you on for this tribute I'm doing for the late author Harlan Ellison. I know you're a writer yourself, and you, along with many others, were influenced by Harlan's writing. How did you first discover Harlan Ellison and his writing?
Well, I'm pretty sure the first thing I ever read of his, I was living with my grandparents in a small village in rural Turkey, of all places. My grandfather built oil refineries, and he was over there working on one, and I went to live with him for a year. And in the compound they had for the expats and their families, they had a sort of a little kind of a lending library in the basement of one of the apartment complexes. It was just a storeroom with, you know, mostly just paperbacks, whatever people had sort of brought and donated. And somebody had donated a box of the digest size sci-fi and fantasy magazines, you know, Asimov, SF&F, Analog. I think there's some Omnis, a couple other weird ones. And so as a kid, you know, I was looking for anything to read. I was a very avid reader from a very, very early age. And so I picked some of them up, and I remember reading a story of his. I don't have his collected work in front of me. I believe it's called Mom. It's the one about the guy who's is a Jewish guy, and his mother is haunting him with sort of that Jewish mother guilt from beyond the grave. And she ends up setting him up with Joan of Arc, I think, at the end. And I that was the first thing I remember reading of Ellison's. And I remember being particularly struck by it because it was so funny. And sweet, which is not something that Ellison is especially known for. It's not an adjective you really use with him. And then later, a few years later, when I was probably 12 or 13, I read Dance Macabre by Stephen King, and he talks a fair amount about Harlan in it. And so I just kind of started reading the stuff that I could find of his, you know, just whatever short stories collections they had in the libraries in the small towns I lived in. And then when I was about 19, I was working in a bookstore out in Long Beach and got a copy of The Essential Ellison, which is the sort of the complete collected, if not complete, it's definitely most of his short work. The thing's about the size of a dump truck. It's this massive collection. And was just fell in love with his anger, I think, more than anything else.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people interpret Harlan Ellison as just some as sort of a misanthropic author, but at the same time, I think he was always angry with good reason in a lot of his writing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Harlan, just as a human being, certainly witnessed a lot of injustice, both, you know, just as a product of his times, and also, you know, as an individual, the things that he wrote about that he had seen. And I think that, no, his anger was absolutely justified, particularly on the social stuff. I think maybe personally, I would think a little bit less so kind of in his private life. And the man was notoriously litigious to a level that to me always kind of seemed like it verged on hysteria. But yeah, I mean, as far as the social stuff and just his kind of his regard of the horrible ways in which humanity treats itself, I think that rage was completely justified. You can see a little bit of it in his contemporary Paddy Chayefsky as well, I think. But even with something like Network, which was, you know, Chayefsky's kind of masterpiece, I don't think he ever got quite to the levels of just, yeah, livid rage that Harlan could channel.
Yeah, it's interesting you make that comparison, too, because I know Harlan would get Harlan would get annoyed when people tried to, like, pigeonhole him, apparently, from people I've talked to. He would get annoyed when people would try to pigeonhole him simply as a sci-fi author. He saw himself working more in the tradition of, like, Kafka.
Yeah. Yeah, and which makes sense. I mean, very little of his work is sci-fi. I mean, in much the same way also that, you know, Bradbury, for all of his stories about Mars and things, those weren't really science fiction stories the way, you know, Asimov wrote sci-fi. They were, I guess maybe to me, they were always the sort of the science fiction version of magical realism. You know, it's as King points out, I believe in Dance Macabre in one of his other stories, he said, you know, Ray Bradbury basically tells you at the beginning of the Martian Chronicles, you know what? There's rockets in the story. That's all you know. That's all you need to know. There's rockets. And from there, the story itself is not about science in any way. And Harlan didn't seem to give a shit about science fiction at all. I mean, he used the trappings of it and he used kind of the tropes of it, but that wasn't, it just doesn't feel the way that a lot of the speculative, I don't know, maybe the geekier stuff feels. The stuff where people are actually the science involved and the futurism involved in the work was really important to them. And that never seemed the case with Harlan. It's a lot like William Gibson, who is nothing like Harlan as a writer, but I know also was enamored of him. You know, Gibson is a writer, is a writer who writes about technology who doesn't actually really get technology very well. And I think Harlan was the same way. I mean, if you read I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, the story about living inside of a computer, it's just nonsense. But that's completely beside the point of what makes that story so effective and horrifying, I think.
Yeah, I Have No Mouth, but I Must Scream is sort of my introduction to him. It's almost like the if that story is like straight out of the nightmares of Elon Musk is what I tell people.
Oh, yeah.
But what I was going to say, it's interesting you mentioned that story in particular, because it's he's definitely not necessarily a hard sci-fi author. He sort of uses some of the trappings of science fiction to tell stories that are very cerebral and psychological in nature.
Yeah, you know, and there were a few of those same kind of guys working around the same time. I think a lot of them, like Harlan, have been kind of forgotten by the sort of the main narrative of science fiction. Like Jack Finney, for example. Finney's most famous work was The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But and he wrote, what was it, Time After Time, Time and Again. I can't remember. The one they made with a movie with Christopher Reeve. But
Time
the thing
After
about Finney
Time,
was that the
one about H.G. Wells and Jack the Ripper and time travel? Or
no, that one's Time After Time. I'm blanking on the name of this one. It was about a guy who travels into the past. God, it's been 20-odd years since I've read it. But Finney was interesting because he was the same way. He was a soft sci-fi writer. So The Invasion of the Body Snatchers is not about, you know, parasites that do mind control. It's about... you know, it's about politics. It's about McCarthyism. Or it's just a guy who came up with an idea, as Finney himself said, you know, what if one day your Aunt Dolores came in and it looked like your Aunt Dolores and sounded like your Aunt Dolores, but it wasn't your Aunt Dolores anymore. And that's, you know, that I think Harlan's basis for everything came from the same place that a lot of the best kind of speculative writers in any genre come from, which is, just the what if, you know, what if this happened? Not necessarily, you know, world building Tolkien kind of stuff. And there's a place for both of those things, but I think there's less. Most of the people who I think at the time that Harlan was kind of in his prime, the people who would have been attracted to the hard sci-fi at that point are people now who just do sort of literary magical realism. You know, like you said about Kafka, I think that if Kafka had been born 40 years later, he probably would have ended up being somebody much like a Harlan Ellison.
Right. And it's It's interesting when you say you've been influenced by him. I don't know in which ways you have, but I've noticed in a lot of your posts and sort of articles or rants that you've had on social media, I detect the same sense of outrage that seems to fuel Harlan Ellison, especially when you've talked about, you know, subjects like Donald Trump. You have that same, like, ah, fuck this bullshit, you know, sort of mentality that Ellison had. He had no, he did not suffer fools easily.
Mm. No, I don't either. And I think that the reason I resonated with him so much when I found his work was it influenced me, but only in the sense that I recognized in him something that I didn't know how to articulate in myself until I saw his work. And yeah, I mean, the thing that fascinates me about someone like Ellison was, and something that I very much strive to emulate about him, was that he was very, you know, almost until his death, was a remarkably fearless writer and was just not afraid of pissing people off. He wasn't afraid of crossing people or angering people or calling people out. And I think that is an incredibly valuable skill. It's also a self-destructive one. I think anybody who's familiar with Ellison's career would probably agree that if he had been even slightly less confrontational over things that ultimately a lot of us would find very hard to take as seriously as he did, I think he probably would have ended up being a far more successful writer commercially. But, I mean, he was willing to tell Gene Roddenberry to go fuck himself because he didn't like the edits on his scripts, which is, you know, I mean, that there's, you have to respect somebody who was that committed to their own artistic vision, I guess, at some point, to the point where they will take the financial hit rather than simply, you know, shrugging it off and saying, well, you know, man's got to make a living, right? And I think that's absolutely, I guess the thing about Harlan, and sorry to sound so unfocused about it, but this is stuff that I've just kind of been thinking about recently. I think the thing that I most admired and tried to emulate about Ellison that he most inspired me in was that whether or not you agreed with anything he wrote, and there were certainly people who agreed with nothing he ever wrote, you cannot look at that work and say that it is not the work of a man who is telling the truth as he sees it. Now, he might be wrong, but he's not lying. He's not making shit up. He's not sugarcoating anything. He's not saying things just to provoke people. That is a man who believes what he says and says what he believes. And that's a rare thing, especially today when everybody wants to be some kind of a personal brand on the internet. You know, and some people who are like that, you know, some of these alt-right assholes who are just dabbling this heinous shit. And you can't imagine they really mean this stuff. But they know that if they spout it, they'll get followers and fans who do believe it. And, you know, you've got these Logan Paul motherfuckers running around. These people who, you know, they're provocateurs without any basis of provocation. They're just being dicks to be dicks. And I don't think you can say that of Ellison, even at his most misanthropic and combative. It was never a guy who was just mouthing off to be an asshole. He really believed what he said.
Right, right. Well, it brings to mind that great line he had in an episode of the show. He had a show called Watching on Sci-Fi, and he had one segment where he said, you know, people think they are entitled to their opinions. No, you are not entitled to your opinion, schmuck. You're entitled to your informed opinion. Otherwise, it's just farting in the wind, was his line. And I say that a lot now to people.
Yeah, and I think where I kind of differ a little from Harlan is that maybe I'm a little more forgiving of people, I think. I think everybody has a right to an opinion. You have the right to believe whatever you want. You want to believe the earth is flat. You want to believe that LeBron James, the greatest athlete of all time. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. You want to believe the Kardashians are interesting. Hey, cool. Whatever, man. Rock and roll. What I don't believe is that people have the right to have any fucking thing they say taken seriously. You can say whatever you want, believe whatever you want, but then that demand for, you know, well, you've got to respect my opinion. No, I don't. I don't have to respect shit. You're a moron. You're probably born a moron. You will probably die a moron, and the entirety of your life is you opening your mouth and moronic shit coming out of it, which you have every right to do, but man, that doesn't mean I'm not going to walk the fuck away or point my finger at you and laugh.
Well, that's how I always took Ellison's adage about it, but yeah, you have a point. He was very hard about it, you know? He had very hard lines about it, but I mean, just look at all these, like, you know, all these, like, anti-vaccination people. You know, they actually end up having a real effect and affecting real lives in a very negative way. So it's like I always sort of sympathized with him on that in a weird way. You know, I think everyone does have a right to their opinion, but it's a matter of you don't have a right to that opinion without consequence. And I will call you a fucking idiot if you think Jenny McCarthy's anti-vaccination shit is, like, you know, where it's at.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just, I don't know. There's a lot of things in the world that I don't know about. I will openly admit to that my knowledge is insufficient for me to form an opinion. You ask me about NASCAR, don't know, don't give a shit. I have no opinions about NASCAR. It's a sport. Apparently, it's where people turn left for an hour. Great, but when it comes to the things that I do know about, I don't express an opinion unless I feel like that opinion has some kind of backing. I don't just say shit to hear my own voice, despite what a lot of people who read my stuff on the internet might think. And so when I see people just talking absolute shit with no idea of what they're talking about and then demanding to be treated like there's some weight behind them, that astonishes me. I have no idea what the hell that is.
Yeah, and I think that's what, like, fed up Harlan Ellison so much. In a way, I think Harlan Ellison sort of wanted to see the best in people. Like, he wanted people to reach their full potential, but he would get angry at the injustice of things, you know? And I know he marched for civil rights. He was a strong proponent of women in sci-fi, although I hear he had his issues with the ladies sometimes. He wasn't always Connie the kindest. What's that?
Yeah. Connie Willis, that yeah.
But overall, I think he was very progressive in a lot of ways.
Absolutely so. I mean, I think that, you know, he was not a perfect person. In a lot of ways, he seemed like he was a son of a bitch. He held grudges for absurd amounts of time, and his private behavior and his public behavior and his public stances did not line up. And there's a lot of stories here about Harlan that you cannot justify. You're just like, okay, the man was probably kind of a prick, but I think that, you know, what you see in Harlan, the same thing you saw in Nina Simone, which may be a weird comparison at first glance, but when you look at somebody like Nina, she was an artist who believed in equality and was absolutely uncompromising to the point where she left her own country because she thought she could not get a fair shake as an artist here. But you listen to something like her song Mississippi Goddamn, which is one of the most incendiary pieces of fucking art of the 20th century. I mean, it's right up there with Goddamn Guernica as in terms of just burning shit down. And you look at that, and then you look at something like, you know, a fictional piece like The Whimper of Whipped Dogs by Ellison, you know, his fictionalization of the Kitty Genovese murder. And you see the exact same anger at the inhumanity of humanity and people's ability to be monsters and the same impatience with the idea that, you know, oh, well, that's just the way things are. I think that Ellison was never satisfied with the way things were and never took the notion of the status quo as being something to be maintained purely because it was the status quo. And, you know, and so for good and for ill, as a person, as an artist, that places him very firmly into a category of revolutionary artists. And I think that ultimately God only knows what his legacy will be. If it'll just be the guy who, you know, grabbed Connie Willis's boob at a sci-fi convention, or I think that's what he did. Or the guy who just, you know, sued Jim Cameron for no apparent reason other than there was some mild resemblance between Terminator and like one of his short stories. I hope that he'll be remembered as this person who was so angry at injustice and the capability for cruelty in his fellow man, and fought and wrote very hard against it for a lot of his life.
Yeah, and you definitely see that in there was a video game adaptation of I Have No Mouth But I'm a Scream, where he actually voices the evil supercomputer. I Am is the name of the supercomputer.
Yeah.
And when he gives that monologue where he's like, I am, you know, and he goes on the monologue about, you know, sort of hating people. You know, it's there's a real anger in there. Like I always thought his contempt was more at people missing the mark of what they could be and what we could be as a society, rather than just this sort of the stuff you see with the alt-right, where it's just like, I hate because I hate, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I think that's very valuable for people who are drawn to those kinds of artists, and I can say this definitely for myself, you know, when I first started really writing as a journalist, even though Harlan was primarily known as a fiction writer, he was one of my influences, and so very much so was Hunter Thompson, which is something that a lot of, you know, I think, especially these days, a lot of young writers go through that. As I grew older, what was really valuable to me as much as their influence on me for what they did was that both of them to me were to some extent cautionary tales. You look at Hunter and, you know, in his later life, pretty much I would say almost everything kind of post Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, Hunter just became a caricature. He was playing to the crowd. So, you know, everything was about, you know, oh, let's get him more drunk. Hey, you know, let's get him to do crazy shit. He became like a talking monkey, you know, just a puppet. And I think that Harlan was somebody who was so consumed with contempt that at some point it started to eat him alive. And, you know, I know people have told me stories about how kind he was to them personally. Even in his later years, but at the same time, he feels like somebody who just, he never stopped being disappointed by people, and he never was able to just at some point just let go of that contempt. And it's something I struggle with, but he was very much an object lesson for me in that sense of what not to do, the same way that Hunter Thompson was an object lesson for me that at some point I didn't need to drink an entire fifth of Jack at the party and go home and eat some mescaline and then write my newspaper column. I mean, that's fun, but, you know, at some point you have to evolve. And if you can't, if your art does not allow you to evolve as a person, then you need to get rid of your fucking art, because ultimately your art is what you'll be remembered for, but you as a person is what you have to look at in the mirror. And I always got the impression that maybe Harlan had a hard time doing that after a while.
Well, I know we have to wrap up here, but I just want to let you recommend some of what you think Harlan's best work is for a lot of my listeners who may be new to his work or younger and not have heard of him before.
Well, I would say The first couple things you want to read, I would start actually with that particular story, which I believe it's either called Mom or Mother, and it's in the Essential Ellison, because that will give you a sense of the man at his kindest. And then I would probably, with the short fiction, I would start with The Whimper of Whipped Dogs, because it's one of the most brutal pieces of fiction I have ever read. There's another one called Croton that is incredibly disgusting. It's about a guy who convinces his girlfriend to get an abortion, And then she makes him go into the sewers to retrieve it. And he finds a colony of aborted fetuses who have survived. And, yeah, it's pretty horrifying.
That's actually Repent come Harlot- up already. The Croton has come up with a few of the interviewees for this tribute.
yeah, that one sticks with you. Repent Harlequin said the TikTok man, obviously. I would say, yeah, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, but do not read it if you're in a bad mood. A Boy and His Dog is great. I actually, I really love the novella. The movies, you know, I liked the movie, but it was very much a product of the, you know, early 70s kind of psychedelia. And there's just a lot of like random weird shit in it. Like, I don't need to see Jason Robards in my makeup dressed like, you know, Buck Owens on Hee Haw for no apparent fucking reason other than we're weird and it's the 70s. But the story's still great. And some of his fiction about like, what's it called? I think it's called A Night in the Tombs, when he was a member of a gang in New York and he ended up going to jail overnight. It was pretty funny. A lot of his TV criticism, the Glass Teeth, that column he had, you know, a lot of it's stuff that it's TV shows nobody remembers, nobody cares about. But it's like Lester Bangs. You don't have to have ever even heard of or give a shit about Black Oak, Arkansas to appreciate a Lester Bangs review of their work. And it's the same thing with Harlan writing about television. But I always, you know, I kind of wonder what I never heard him really talk about television as it's evolved. I would have liked to have known his thoughts about something like Westworld. Though I suspect he would have found some reason to hate it because he seemed to find a reason to hate pretty much everything. But I always wondered if the things that have been happening in television as a long form narrative medium recently if he was gratified by it, since so much of what we've been doing over the last kind of 10, maybe 20 years of television has been really starting to fulfill the promise of what he envisioned going all the way back to, you know, the Twilight Zone days.
Right. And that's another thing people often forget he did. He wrote a few episodes of The Outer Limits, and he wrote for the sci-fi 80s revival of the Twilight Zone. A lot of people say his episode, Shatterday, was like one of the only good episodes of that revival in the 80s.
Yeah, and they did an adaptation of his story Crazy as a Soup Sandwich, too, I remember.
Yes, that one,
Yeah, the new Twilight Zone I was never a huge fan of. It definitely had slightly better production values than Bradbury's Tales from the Dark Side, which in retrospect, when I was a kid, you know, I was terrified of it. And I watched an episode a couple years ago and I was like, Jesus, this is awful. Like the production was so bad. The sets wobbled when the, you know, actors walked on them. You know what I mean? And it's interesting because I can, you know, that's what's so funny is like, you look at something like Ellison, you look at what he had to work with these limitations of like, you know, 1960s American television censorship. And, you know, just the fact that television had no budget because it was always the second string thing. And then if you imagine like Ellison writing or creating an HBO series now, what would that look like? And that's something I'm very sad that we don't get to see.
Well, you know, there's a graphic novel of his original script for the Star Trek episode City on the Edge of Forever. And it's funny because when you look at the graphic novel, what he wanted to do probably would not have been possible in the days where William Shatner was playing Captain Kirk. So,
yeah. Well, you know, one of the interesting things when you go back and look at old media, particularly if you go through it without the eyes of nostalgia, is, I mean, if you look at the old Star Trek series, the writing occasionally had its moments of brilliance. Some of the ideas were great, but the actual TV show itself was pretty fucking garbage, and the acting was atrocious. I mean, there's a reason, you know, you had the Galaxy Quest kind of parody of that stuff. And so for somebody like Harlan, he was so impatient anyway, as a creative person, I'm just imagining him trying to deal with trying to, you know, pour the sort of serious thought into, you know, 60s sci-fi TV and these sad shows with the, you know, $20 sets. It's just, it's like, there's an old story. I think it might even be by Bruce Sterling called Mozart in Mirror Shades. And the basic premise is, you know, what would Mozart do with a synthesizer? What would he be able to do with modern musical technology? And it's the same thing. You kind of wonder, okay, so what happens if you sit 25-year-old Harlan Ellison down in 2018 and you say, yeah, we got a budget of $2 million per episode here, Harlan. Oh, and you can show boobs. I mean, can you imagine what he would do with some sort of, you know, a miniseries of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream with, you know, HBO money?
Harlan Ellison's Westworld. I'm trying to picture that.
Right, which actually wouldn't be that far off, but I mean, yeah, or you know, Repent Harlequin, turning that into something on, you know, like a Netflix series. I mean, that would be amazing. It would be amazing to see what he could have done, because what he was able to do with the limited resources he had in that medium was still fairly impressive. But what could he have done when the sky was a limit, man? That's an interesting question to me.
Right. Like, I want to thank you again for coming on. Is there any, like, last things you want to get in there about Harlan Ellison and his influence on you?
I would say, particularly to any of your readers who are not familiar to him and are coming to him after his death, particularly colored by the fact that rightfully a lot of people after his death have tried to point out some of the kind of shittier things that he did as a human being, which are it's absolutely true. I mean, you can't deny that he did some pretty fucked up shit, but it's a lot like Lovecraft. Lovecraft was a horrible racist and just kind of a misogynist and basically a freak. But if you know that going in and you recognize it, you can still see what it is that people find valuable about that person and their work. Despite the problems that they have, particularly to a modern audience. And I would say, you know, Harlan's not really, there's not a lot of latent racism or homophobia or really sexism in his work comparatively to the time, but you know, there's still stuff in there. That's going to make you wonder, but keep in mind that the core of what made him valuable was that inability to suffer fools, that vast and raging sense of resentment and injustice. And like all people who are angry at injustice, he was somebody who believed in justice and believed in a better world. And when Harlan was at his best was those moments in the rage when you could see his vision of what a better world might look like. And that will always be, to me, the most valuable thing about him.
And just out of curiosity, because I don't think I ever heard him make any public comment on it, what do you think he thought of Donald Trump?
I can't imagine that he was surprised at this point. I know he had a stroke before the election, and I suspect that he probably wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to politics. But in some ways, Donald Trump was very much the outcome of his prophecies as to what society was going to. I think that for Harlan, the idea that Americans would elect a low grade functioning moron with all of the moral sense of a Wolverine who signed up as a Barbary Coast pirate, a fucking reality television star. I don't think that would surprise Harlan at all. I think Harlan, that would have been exactly what he was seeing and trying to warn us about, and exactly the sort of thing that we didn't want to listen to. And so it's like he always said, you know, I'm just going to laugh at you fuckers and say I told you so. And he did, and he was right.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you, Joshua Ellis, for participating in Parallax Views, tribute to the late sci-fi author. Well, I'm going to say just the late great author in general, Harlan Ellison.
Thank you, sir.
I'm not saying that there were not foolishness, love beads, and people streaking. And I mean, when an entire decade, and we're talking about a decade that runs from about 61, 62 to about 75, so it's more than 10 years. But that era, when one talks about it in terms of its dumbest parts rather than its most noble parts, you know you are dealing with a prejudiced, with a closed, and with a mean-spirited mind. And that's what they invariably do. They don't talk about any of the things that all of the emerging African nations, the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, they see the worst parts of all of these things because they fear change. These are the reactionary elements that have been in our society since the very beginning. We have been always a fiercely anti-intellectual nation, fiercely anti-intellectual. If you're so smart, why ain't you wealthy? Or you can't fight City Hall, or who the hell do you think you are, or I'm entitled to my opinion. No, schmuck, you are not entitled to your opinion. You are entitled to your informed opinion. Without information, it's just babble, hot air, and farts in the wind. So the 60s was a period in which a lot of things were questioned.
And that was a clip of one of Harlan Ellison's more famous politically cantankerous moments, speaking about the 1960s. And of course, making the famous quote about you're not entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to your informed opinion. Schmuck. Next up, though, we have a conversation with C. Derek Varn of Zero Books and the author of the recently released poetry collection Apocalyptics. Pick it up, folks. And if you're looking to hear more from C. Derek Varn, you can always subscribe to Zero Books Patreon to hear C. Derek Varn's Symptomatic Redness and the podcast I co-host with him, Alternatives. And now to my conversation with C. Derek Varn. Welcome back to Parallax Views, C. Derek Varn.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. So I wanted to have you back on for this tribute I'm doing for Harlan Ellison. You know, the great sci-fi author. How did you first become aware of Harlan Ellison's work?
Star Trek. Like almost everybody, Star Trek. But I think the first thing I really read by him in particular, if I really think about it, it was 1997. And I remember because I was a junior in high school and I was in a friend of mine's house and we just watched Braveheart, of all things. And he had a large expanded, like, nice coffee table version with, like, early computer art of Repent Harlequin Said the TikTok Man on his coffee table. All right. And I knew the name from Star Trek. So I opened it up and I read it, and you know, it's almost that particular story is almost like a children's book story, but there was something else going on there. So I read that and sat on the back burner for a few years. I was into like J.G. Ballard and a lot of M. John Harrison and a lot of the new wave British sci-fi from the 70s and some American too. I really liked Thomas Ditch at the time, and Ellison's name just kept on cropping up. So when I was about 21 years old, I was about to graduate from college. I went, I got one of those sci-fi book club mailers. Do you know anything about these?
No. What are those?
Do you remember like Columbia House for CDs?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. I mean, I don't know your age, but you could always like, you know, pay like, I don't know, buy like 5 CDs and then like 8 for free and then cancel it immediately. Right. Sci-Fi Book Club did the same thing for, like, books. And so one of the things I got was the Pain God stories and the Deaf Bird stories in my first collection of Sci-Fi Book Club, because I just remember that name from that coffee table book and from Star Trek. And I read those, and they blew my mind when I was 21. Now, they weren't. I mean, Ellison's a good writer, but he's not like a J.G. Ballard where you could see him easily crossing into literary fiction almost immediately. But he was a robust and kind of muscular writer. And he read better than a lot of the pulpy stuff I've read. He obviously was cantankerous in his prose. I mean, that was clear in those books. And, you know, from what I've read about him, it's only gotten more so. And I went back after that. I remember I found the video game of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
That's a very fun one. It's a very odd game, too, because you can't really win it.
No, yeah. And eventually I got the Dangerous Visions anthologies. And they introduced me to a lot of my favorite sci-fi writers, like Samuel Delaney and Franz Lieber. And then, you know, some sci-fi writers who I like but don't necessarily love, like Philip Jose Farmer and Brian Aldiss and Larry Niven. So, I mean, in a couple of ways, you know, my love of new wave sci-fi brought me to Ellison. But in some other ways, it was him who brought a whole lot of people that may have fallen under my radar because I was, you know, an English major and a science nut, and would probably have ignored it as too pulpy and not realistic enough in my early 20s.
It's interesting because I know Harlan Ellison, whenever people referred to him as a sci-fi author, he would sort of like go into freak out mode and get like real angry. He'd be like, I'm not just some genre author. You know, I'm more like Kafka.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's tons of people who do that though. And to some degree he's right. I mean, it's similar to a lot of the new wave science fiction people like Thomas Ditch or J.G. Ballard, that he was not, or even someone maybe like Ray Bradbury, who wasn't properly speaking a sci-fi writer. His concerns were not necessarily science fiction. They were more conceptual. So in that sense, he had a point. But he did almost solely work in various genre writing. It wasn't just sci-fi, but that was the tropes he went back to over and over again. Now, if you read, like, Pain God, it's clear that he's all over the place. Some of those stories are highly metaphorical. Some of them are straight-up sci-fi. And that's true for Deathbird stories, too. So, you know, yeah.
He's a very unusual writer in a lot of ways. One of the things that always stood out to me is, you know, the cantankerousness is what everyone notices. And I think some people have sort of written him off as like a misanthropic writer, but I don't think he's misanthropic in a, in sort of a nihilistic way, if that makes sense. He's someone that's always telling morality tales in a lot of ways. He's sort of disappointed with people's not going to their full potential and not doing the right things.
Yeah, I mean, he was a moralist in a very class. I mean, that's probably why he's a big influence on me. I also, when I write, tend to be kind of a moralist, although I'm not as interested in didactic prose. And in some ways, I don't think Ellison was either, which is why he kept on going back to genre tropes, because it was easier to be moralistic without being didactic. I think about, I believe it was in the Deathbird stories. The first story that really hit me is this story that's kind of about Kenny Giudice. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I don't have that book with me at the moment, but yeah, it was The Whimper of Wimp Dogs.
That one keeps coming up in the rest of the interviews for this tribute.
That story blew my mind. And then some other ones from that collection that blew my mind were adrift off the incident of Lagerhans and the Deathbird, and also Pain God, but Pain God also got expanded out to its own collection later on. There's also a story in there. What was the name of it? About cars that was really kind of classic stuff. It's really good. You just got the feeling that Ellison was a much more mature version of what you would see on like a Twilight Zone, you know, sort of deal where the moralism is there. And the twist endings and shock value are there, and the edge, you know, is there, but it's never there. None of those things are there for their own sake. They all inform each other. And he was commenting on a lot of the social trends of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And some of them, I mean, he's really prescient on. I mean, you know, some stuff he's writing about in the 70s feels a lot more on the pulse of the way things were going to be in the 80s and a lot of other stuff. And I think his popularity kind of bloomed in the 1990s because that was a time, you know, we talk about 90s edgelords or whatever, but that was a time when I think his moralism mixed with his kind of cynical worldview was more appreciated. But also the fact that he didn't go into pure nihilism or even like Ligotti's, I have a hard time calling Ligotti actually a nihilist myself, but same, Ligotti's same. Ligotti's hyper depressive psychological realism. It's not that either. He was very much part of the new wave, but he's different than the British ones. I mean, he doesn't read like J.G. Ballard, even J.G. Ballard's short stories. I mean, it's his morality is a little simpler. And if I have one criticism, is sometimes he was given to hyperbole in his morality tales. I mean, some of your other. So he wasn't always super nuanced, but that's not a consistent problem he has. So it's one of those things that's really hard to do. Oh, and the other thing I would really credit him for that I think is super important and kind of amazing is introducing me to Gene Wolfe, who's probably the most influential writer in my life. Because he published a bunch of Gene Wolfe stories in the, you know, 72 Dangerous Visions.
Well, he was very well known for helping young authors. You know, he helped Dan Simmons and Poppy Z. Bright, among many, many others.
Oh, yeah. I would say Poppy Z. Bright is kind of an underrated author. I think she's tainted with being associated with a very specific kind of New Orleans subculture of the late 1990s.
Well, yeah. He now.
I didn't know that.
Poppy Z. Bright transitioned. It's Billy Martin now.
Oh,
it's Billy Martin now. Yeah,
I completely did not know that. So I am accidentally a douchebag on that one. Well, I did not know Poppy Z was now Billy Martin, but that makes some sense because I like Billy Martin too, and I did not know they were the same person somehow. I wasn't up on that one. I know that some other trans writers associated with Poppy Z. Bright had transitioned, but I didn't know that he had. All right. Well,
I wanted to get back real quick to what you said about much of Harlan's work being prescient. In what way? In what way do you think it was prescient?
Well, he was playing with a lot of the social alienation that was kind of bubbling up in the 70s, but he saw some of the more extreme things that were going to come out of that in the 80s and 90s, I think. If you, like, I'm really thinking about the Deathbird, I mean, the Deathbird Stories collection, where there's just a bunch of things that, you know, kind of rhymes with other things. I mean, there's a story in there that kind of rhymes with The Purge, but also kind of rhymes with Death Wish 2000. I can't remember the name of the story right now, but there's just trends that it's hard to know if he was on the pulse of the culture and saw them ahead of time, or if he was, you know, actually inspired those trends because of all the other authors he helped make famous. I mean, Harlan Ellison is in some ways known for being cantankerous, and other ways he's known for being like the Lou Reed, also known for being cantankerous, of like popular in genre fiction, because he inspired so many people who kind of picked up what he was doing and went beyond him. Now that's not always the case in the sense that we might mean. But I'll give you another example: The Deaf Bird, which is clearly a Gnostic, like an explicit Gnostic metaphor. That Gnostic stuff that he's picking up on in that mid-70s, by the time you get to the 1990s, it's everywhere. Like, you can't watch The Matrix or even Aeon Flux without seeing it. And yet he's picking up on it and using it as an allegorical way of talking about alienation in 1975, 74 even. So, yeah.
Right. It's interesting too, because I was thinking recently of he did a short story called Shatter Day, which was later made into a Twilight Zone revival episode featuring a very young Bruce Willis. And that story was dealing with Jungian archetypes. So he was doing that while Jordan Peterson was probably still in his diapers.
Well, yeah, but on the Jungian archetype stuff, the funny thing about that is that stuff has fallen out of favor and then come back like several times. It was out of favor in the 80s. It came back and then in the early 90s. Cause I mean, like, I read Jung in high school. All right. It fell out in favor again in the aughts and most of the last decade. And Jordan Peterson's repopularized it. But yeah, you know, he does a lot with archetypes. He does a lot with extended metaphors and conceits. He does a lot with what are kind of, so if you take hard sci-fi as often like focusing on the effects of, say, one technological change or one social change, like, and just trying to follow that through, the new wave sci-fi kind of didn't do that. It was more interested in picking up on a conceptual shift or a philosophical question. I mean, you see this in the early works of J.G. Ballard too, like all the time. And playing, but not necessarily the effects of one bit of technology, but the effects of one literalized metaphor. And Ellison's kind of a master of that. That's why, like, you think of him and you think of you really do think of the Twilight Zone. I mean, like, he's perfect for it.
And the Outer Limits, which he did a few episodes for, that famous one. I think it was like called The Soldier, which ended up being. You know, he sued James Cameron over that because he claimed James Cameron stole his story for The Terminator.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because Harlan Ellison's, like I told you, when I was 17, I encountered the TikTok Man. There's a poem I wrote when I was 19 years old that contains the title of one of his books on it, which I talk about. It's in a poem called Miscarriage, and I'm not going to read it to you, but where I use loving nothing but sex misspelled. In the poem as a reference to Ellison, although, I mean, it's really just because I'm playing with the idea, but he was very good at those sorts of issues. I mean, and, you know, you're right, he was a moralist. He was a cynic. I mean, you definitely get a sense, if you know anything about his personal life, that he part of the moralism came out of his own inability to really, like, maintain normal human relationships.
Right. I've been told that by people that have read a lot about Ellison's biography that he was a figure that had a lot of like early trauma and whatnot, and it sort of shows in his his writing.
Well, I mean, he doesn't really meet, if it shows in his writing, it shows in his personal life. I mean, he couldn't stay with a woman until his last wife in 1986. I mean, he was married 5 times. And, you know, like, although, I mean, I hate to say it, even though he died recently, I sort of thought he was already dead. So, because in 2004, I remember he had a stroke, and I just sort of thought he faded away after that. So, unfortunately for me. It's kind of amazing how many people he inspired, you know. So, I mean, you know, even Stephen King, who is also kind of enjoying a weird heyday right now. And weirdly, in the sense that, like, even people who normally talk about... Because when I was in the 90s and when I was in high school, when I was in my undergrad, until Stephen King's On Writing came out, we always used King as a model for what not to do as a writer. You know, even though he's super famous, even though, like, his books did incredibly well... He was such an inconsistent writer that he was kind of used as a model for just, like, being hacky. But King, and I think somewhat deservedly, actually, has enjoyed also a comeback recently, partly because of movies and partly because I think people are going back and rereading particularly his short stories, which tend to, if he can end them, which is always a big if for him, are usually pretty good. Now, Ellison didn't have that problem. Ellison could almost always end a short story. You got the feeling that he worked from, and I don't know, I've never read that he actually did this, but his stories are just read to me like he would come up with a conceit, then he'd come up with an ending and work to it. So sometimes his characters can feel a little slighter because they're not so much characters as ideas. But he had clear and sometimes, you know, really bracing and shocking endings.
Well, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream is probably the one everyone references, that it's very jarring.
Oh yeah, it's you know, it's something else. I mean, even something like, you think about his Star Trek episode, A City on the Edge of Forever.
By the way, that was recently, I guess, made into a graphic novel using his original script, and it ends up being very different than the Roddenberry episode.
So how is it different? I mean, I think that for classic Star Trek, though, that's such a dark script. I mean,
I guess the graphic novel is, like, much more elaborate, and they I was told that the graphic novel shows that the script could have never been made into what Harlan Ellison wanted. It would have cost it too much at the time.
Well, yeah, but I mean, just the idea that Kirk, I mean, and again, this isn't a particularly groundbreaking idea, but in the context of Roddenberry's positive worldview, it's an incredibly dark episode. You know, Kirk falls in love with, what was Joan Collins's character's name? Edith Keller? I don't remember. Probably Edith Keller. And in order to save the future, he's got to allow her to die. Okay, that's not a huge, you know, groundbreaking idea, even in 1967. But it's such a tone shift and, you know, and it has so much higher stakes than Star Trek normally had in its classic run. You know, although, I mean, again, the episode we got wasn't just written by him. There are two uncredited authors who revised it to make it more compliant with Roddenberry, but you know, it's still so tonally different than the rest of the show in a lot of ways.
Well, I was gonna say too, you know, it's interesting seeing a lot of the obituaries that have been coming out for Harlan Ellison, because a lot of them have been they're either very like very positive or extremely negative. He was a very polarizing figure. And I think the New Republic sort of basically came to the conclusion. They argued that, you know, well, Harlan Ellison could write, but ultimately his stories are from a bygone era. And, you know, he only wrote within his generation. What do you think about that criticism?
I think it's horseshit.
I agree.
I mean, look, I don't think he was writing for us. But if you look at the stuff he's writing in the 60s and 70s and the way it feels to people from the 90s and aughts, yeah, some of it's a little bit insensitive for our ears, but I don't think it's a bygone era at all. He was ahead of his time. But his time, really, I mean, his heyday of writing is the 60s and 70s, particularly the 70s. But, I mean, a lot of his best stories are written in the 60s, too. He's still writing, you know, well into the... Well into what? The early aughts? I'm actually not entirely sure about that. But I don't think he's particularly... I mean, look, if you're going to say that about Ellison, you'd also have to say it about someone like Philip K. Dick. Because, like, social... You want to talk about, like, social attitudes being retrograde or something. Like, Dick's opinion of women is manifested in the stories is profoundly weird.
And that's also the big criticism with Harlan Ellison.
And in some cases it's true, but there are other cases in his stories where he has a very sympathetic view of women. I am actually thinking of that kind of Giudizzi story again.
Well, he was very much a humanist in his preferred, you know, political or ideological outlook.
Right, and so I don't think that's as limited as people think. I do think, yes, it's. I mean, even if you look at The Whimper of a Well-Whipped Dog, I mean, like, I think Joanna Rush, who I think her credentials as a feminist sci-fi writer is unquestionable, would say that it was... It didn't have that Ellison would often not have a very realistic view about violence or wouldn't deal with its origins very well, but he was very good at trying to embody the results of it and show it humanistically. So, I mean, no, he's not without shortcoming by any stretch of the imagination. I want to sound like a fanboy who defends him against all charges of sexism, but I also don't think it's as simple to discount his writing because of those flaws, if you admit they're there. I mean, it's there's this tendency right now in a lot of literary punditry, and I'm going to call it punditry, not criticism, because it's a lot of it's not truly criticism. It's because it doesn't deal with the way the aesthetics and the moral points and all this actually interplay. It just deals with whatever moral outcomes that it thinks it views, where Ellison and people like him are discounted for their foibles, but they're not read sympathetically at all. And I don't think that's the right thing. I also think, yeah, you can criticize Ellison for not having a fully realized portrait of woman. Most people didn't. But to say that it's just of his time both undercuts his vision as a writer and actually in some ways he lets him off the hook, you know, simultaneously. I mean, Joanna Rush was criticizing him and also talking about how important he was, you know, in the 70s. So it's not like people didn't see it contemporary, you know, didn't see both traits contemporaneously to his, you know, most productive writing period. So to just say that those problems are just a product of the generation and also, like, he's not, we shouldn't take him that seriously, even though he was a good writer, because he was a product of his generation, is kind of a cop out and also doesn't give him enough credit at the same time.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We say the same thing about Lovecraft, right? Like, you and I talked about that. A lot of the stuff about, oh, Lovecraft is just of his time. And I don't think Ellison's view of women is comparable to Lovecraft's view of race, by the way. But in some ways, that's underselling it. In other ways, that's not giving him enough credit.
Right, right. And it's I mean, there's also been I guess some people are very jarred by his sort of homophobic tendencies at times as well. But I think at the same time, he's always it's weird. It's like there's I don't want to go and look at the whole art versus the artist thing, but you know, it seems like Ellison was very progressive in his thinking in a lot of ways socially, while at the same time being personally like having his you know, old cantankerous nature in him.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was politically very progressive. Although, I mean, it's interesting because not all the, you know, you want to think of a writer who's almost Ellison's opposite. I mentioned Gene Rolfe. Gene Rolfe seems extremely progressive personally and what he tolerates. There's no outings of him as like being particularly homophobic or particularly reactionary, even in some of his most right wing writings, which his first novel really was. But I mean, his second novella, The Three Heads of Sybaris, is known, you know, for being hyper important in post-colonial studies, and being very awake to those issues. And this man is a highly conservative Catholic who had like a very pro-labor, but pro-labor in the, like, even in the way that, say, Pope Benedict had. In a way, Ellison was promoting someone who in most things was his polar opposite. I mean, Gene Wolfe was critical of Vietnam, but he was very pro military, and he was a soldier and engineer before he started writing. And I only bring him up as a contrast because I don't think, and it's interesting to me because I don't think people are talking about how Gene Rolfe is of his age. One, because Rolfe is still writing, even though he's very old. And two, Rolfe is a conservative and his views were conservative by the standards of any age that he was alive in. And he gets a lot of credit for being personally sympathetic and kind of progressive minded on labor and having a very sympathetic ear towards women. And oppress peoples and stuff, and yet he's a diehard conservative. So I don't think you can. I do think you can't totally separate out the artist from their politics. But you know, as a writer myself, you could read a book of my poetry and not. I mean, people keep on talking about how it's dialectical and there's this Marxism in there, and I keep on saying, like, no, well, that might be true, but I sure as hell didn't mean it to be. And I don't think it's a Marxist political text at all. So you have to be careful with that.
Well, the note I want to wrap up on, if you could, what do you think are some of the best works or the works you would recommend to newcomers, newbies to Harlan Ellison? And also, what do you think Harlan's legacy will be? I know that's a two-parter.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I would actually say start with Repent, Harlequin, because you can understand it. It's easy. And then if I was going to suggest a larger work, I would tell people to read all of either the Deathbird stories or of Stranger Wines. What is it?
I think that's it. Yeah.
Those two collections are, they have set with me for a long time. I also don't mind the Pain God collection, but it's very similar to the Deathbird stories. In fact, that story's even in the Deathbird stories. So, you know, maybe just go to Deathbird. After that, I'd say his legacy may actually, I don't want to say that he's not an important writer. I clearly think so. But his legacy for me is in the two dangerous visions he actually finished. You know, although there is always the infamous third dangerous visions, which was like stalled for like 15 years or something. I don't know. It was a long time. It never came out. So partly because Ellison, if you read those dangerous visions, one of the things Ellison does that's amazing is he writes intros to those stories that are sometimes as long or longer than the stories themselves.
He was very known for his critical commentary. One of the things he started out doing was a column called The Glass Tit, I believe, about television in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah, I mean, I think that stuff is great. And I think that may be his legacy. And I'm sure people are going to want to update him, update his visions if they were going to deal with him now. But I don't think I don't think we can easily just I don't think he's going to go in the dustbin of history. I really don't. He's not going to be, you know, and there are authors that are in the dustbin of history that I really wish weren't. So, for example, I think, like, Thomas Ditch needs to be remembered for stuff more than The Brave Little Toaster, and Harrison needs to be read again, and not just for the fact that he wrote Make Room, which became Soul and Green. Although people should read that book and not just see that movie, which they only really know for the last line anyway. You know, I don't think he's going to be one of those people. I also don't know if he's going to be a clear, like, major genre writer in the way that, say, King is, or even Gene Wolfe is. I mean, Gene Wolfe is the genre writer, because he's a better prose fiction writer than a lot of literary fiction writers.
Do you think that, it took very long for Philip K. Dick to be more accepted? You know, now you could easily do a grad thesis on Philip K. Dick. Do you think Harlan Ellison will ever get that level of acclaim?
Maybe. I mean, the thing is with Dick is Dick was so influential to a lot of bad, but important, bad in like the fine art sense, but bad-ish, but it's super important 80s and 90s sci-fi movies that people got interested in going to see what the source material really was. And he was prescient on things about, like, identity and shifts of identity and cyber culture in ways that seem weird now. But what's interesting is how he got prescient on that was his weird obsession with Gnosticism, not really a total understanding of the technology. And I think Ellison has some similar overlaps, his use of Jungian archetypes and his kind of use of, like, dark god mythologies probably is not going to go away anytime real soon. And so I think that's fruitful for study. But he's going to have to be dead a little while before we know. I mean, unfortunately, with very few exceptions, Ursula K. Le Guin and Wade Bradbury being them, and to a lesser extent, Neil Gaiman, normally those kinds of authors are not resurrected until they are well dead. I mean, Dick and Lovecraft were basically canonized around the same time, which was in the mid-aughts, even though they've been important in genre and stuff forever. Well, for the last century. So, you know, I think we'll see some of that with Ellison. I also think, I think his work on The Outer Limits in Star Trek and the fact that he probably inspired parts of Terminator and stuff, I think he'll get some recognition. And one of the dirty secrets of this, JG, is academia actually does kind of tail pop culture on some of this stuff, despite claiming, you know, at least used to claiming that it was above it. But even Stephen King has developed a scholarly interest as of late. So, and it's probably because he's reaching the end of his life. But
yeah, it's funny you mention that, because Billy Martin is actually writing a whole, like, scholarly project about Stephen King as his stories relate to spirituality. So maybe we'll see something like that for Harlan at some point.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the moment where I started seeing things shift with Stephen King. It's I want to say, uncontroversially for a lit snob like myself, that I think Stephen King's best book is his book on writing. One, it's such good prose in that book. And two, his advice is actually generally pretty good. What's funny is he doesn't usually take it. But I got taught that in an MFA. You know, we read that in an MFA course. And when that happens with someone who was considered kind of a popular hack by by snobby avant-garde writers like myself, it means that they're probably going to be taken seriously. You know, and I said this even when I was in college. I said that Stephen King is like a horror writer's version of Charles Dickens. Like, there's a lot there. There's also a lot that isn't very good, but there's so much that, you know, he'll be remembered. Ellison's going to be the same way. I mean, he's not remembered for novels. I will say that, you know, I mean, I guess A Boy and His Dog, but in general, he's not remembered for novels. He's remembered for short stories. But, well, even A Boy Is This Dog is what? It's a novella. It's not even really a novel. But, so he's got that disadvantage. But that didn't stop people from, you know, remembering Ray Bradbury. And I think once you, I think the issue that Ellison may have, okay, is that there's not many of his stories you could teach the high schoolers. For content reasons. And part of the reason why Philip K. Dick and, you know, Ray Bradbury have stayed, you know, part of it's they're good writers. Although on a prose level, Philip K. Dick can be pretty awkward in some of his short stories, but, is they're good writers. But the other part is that they have some stories that are conceptually interesting enough and complicated enough without being too complicated to teach in high school. I've taught Ray Bradbury stories. I've taught Philip K. Dick stories. I would have a hard time getting away with teaching the better Harlan Ellison stories, except for Repent Harlequin, which I'm pretty sure probably is taught in high school somewhere.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground, and I think you've contributed a lot to this discussion that I've been having with a lot of people about Harlan Ellison. I want to thank you again, C. Derek Barn, for coming on Parallax Views. Looking forward to doing another episode of Alternative sometime soon.
Yep, and I always like coming on Parallax Views because you get to talk about something other than being made to talk about politics, which is always refreshing. All right, have a good day, JG.
They want everything for nothing. They wouldn't go for 5 seconds without being paid. And they'll bitch about how much they're paid and want more. I should do a freebie for Warner Brothers? What is Warner Brothers out, you know, with an eye patch and a tin cup on the street? Fuck no. They always want the writer to work for nothing. And the problem is that there's a goddamn many writers who have no idea that they're supposed to be paid every time they do something. They do it for nothing. Good, good. They're going to look at me. I'm going to be noticed. What? You tell me, are they any less the media whore than I? I think not. They just haven't, nobody's offered to buy their soul. I sell my soul, but at the highest rates. The highest rates. I don't take a piss without getting paid for it. I get so angry about this because you're undercut by all the amateurs. It's the amateurs who make it tough for the professionals. Because when you act professional, these people are so used to getting it for nothing and for mooching. And for being able to pass off this bullshit. I mean, they don't even send you a copy of the DVD. You know, you have to call them and say, where's the DVD? Well, it's been out for 6 months. You know, you could go to the store and buy it. You could go to the store and buy it, motherfucker. You go to the store and buy it. You send me the goddamn DVD now, or I'm going to come down to your office, and I'm going to burn it to the ground. How about that? Well, you don't have to get mean about it. Yeah, I do have to get mean about it. 6 months since the damn thing came out.
Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views. With Parallax Views. To Parallax Views. With Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it. Just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.